That's the enthusiasm I like to hear on a Sunday morning. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Thank you, John. That's brilliant. Guys, it's great to be here, and it's a real honour. Like, sometimes I have to pinch myself that I get to, part of my job is to come and teach from the Bible. I mean, what a joy that is. So I hope that this is going to be helpful for us today. The plan today is to kind of land from what we've been doing in our sermon series, Seeking God's Kingdom First. And we've also looked at, I think I've got the wrong clicker, that's why. But we've also been looking at God's heart. Can you just click on for me, please? That's right. God's heart, and another one. God's heart for the least in society. And I don't know about you, but I've been really struck by it. We had James Spencer from Compassion come and share about God's heart for children and how his heart has broken for children across the world and works for compassion, seeking at bringing children out of poverty. And something that the Lord's put on his heart is to be part of that and to help bring the end of child poverty across the world. We know, obviously, it's the Lord's is in control, but he inspires us and encourages us to share his heart like he has for children. We also saw that God's heart is for the outsider. We also saw that God's heart is for the least, the sinner, the poor and the oppressed. And we had Keely from Embrace came and shared about the work that she does on the streets in Handsworth with women that are in need of help in an industry that is really brutal for them. And we saw her heart just shine through in her passion because she shares God's heart for that people group. We also saw last week that Simon came and shared about God's heart for the foreigner. Those that we're all sojourners, we're all kind of exiles until we return to heaven, until we're in heaven. But there's a special heart that God has for those that are maybe overlooked in society. And where I want to land today is really looking at our hearts. Do we share God's heart? Do we share God's heart? And because I think he wants us to. And I really want us to be hearers and doers of the word. That if the Lord is prompting us to do something off the back of this sermon series of sharing his heart for the poor and the oppressed and the least in society, that we would, by the Spirit's help, be bold enough to take a step today of what does that look like? What is he calling me to do differently in sharing his heart? How is that going to play out this week, this month, and in the years to come in your life? I've been challenged by this because I realized that maybe my heart isn't as broken for people as God's heart is. And that's been my prayer over this series for me, is that my heart would break more for those that are in need the most. And also we have to remember that we are all outsiders. We were all cast away from God, weren't we? Far from him. We were all the least because we all were in need of a Savior that would be able to pay our sin and make a way back for us to be with the Father. And from that place, I hope we see that today, that it's from that place of knowing how much we have been loved and how much God's heart is for us that we are able to move towards others and show God's heart for them. I think we are that church, but I want us to grow in being that church that welcomes the stranger, welcomes everybody, especially those that maybe are more difficult to love, like me. And so we're going to be in Isaiah 58 today. We're going to take it a little bit at a time. We're not going to read the whole thing in one go. We're going to read a little bit at a time, a little bit each time. And I want us to see that God's heart is a heart of justice and mercy. And he wants ours to be the same, that he wants our faith to reach the streets. Our faith is not to stay here, but it's to go out and reach the streets and to show his heart to others. So let's read Isaiah 58, verses 1 to 2 to begin with. It's on the screen, but it's also in your Bibles. It reads this. This is God speaking to Isaiah. Shout it aloud. Do not hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet. Declare to my people their rebellion and to the descendants of Jacob their sins. For day after day, They seek me out. They seem eager to know my ways, as if they were a nation that does what is right and has not forsaken the commands of its God. Straight away in this passage, we see there's a tension going on. The people of Israel are doing everything right on the outside, God's people at the time. They're praying, they're fasting, they're going to worship, they're studying the scriptures, but there is something wrong. And God says to Isaiah, shout it aloud, don't hold back. In other words, I need you to wake up because you think that you're close to me, but you're not. They had the form of religion, but not the heart of it. They were singing the songs, but ignoring the suffering that was going on. They were fasting from food, but they were feasting on injustice. And here's the shocking thing. They thought their problem was that God wasn't paying attention to them. But God says, no, you're the ones that aren't paying attention. And if we're honest, actually, Isaiah 58 could be written to us as Christians today, God's people. We live in a time when churches can be relatively well attended at times, but the communities around them are still full of loneliness. We still see poverty, don't we? And we see division. And we can be raising our hands on a Sunday in worship and yet close our hearts and hands to people in need. We can talk about faith, but does our faith leave the building once we get out of here? And just like Israel, we might wonder, God, why are you not showing up in power? Why are you not answering our prayers? Why don't we feel your presence like we used to? God's reply might well be the same. What's your worship? Has it become disconnected from your compassion? And so the central question that Isaiah 58 is really asking us is, what kind of worship does God actually want from us? Is he impressed by our songs, our fasting and our prayers? Or is he actually looking for something a little bit deeper, a worship that flows from the heart into the hands? From 58 the High Street on into our communities. From the love of God into the love of neighbor. This chapter tells us that God's definition of true spirituality has always included justice and mercy, doing justice and mercy. A lot of the content from today is based off some stuff that I've been reading with Tim Keller. Some of you may know Tim Keller, sadly passed away 12 months ago. Wonderful guy that ran a really large church in New York, or grew a large church in New York, and was really focused on making sure that all that they had didn't stay within the church, but went out upon the streets of New York. And Tim Keller says this. He says, if you grasp, he said it a lot better than this. If you grasp the gospel of grace, you'll do justice, not out of guilt, but out of gratitude. Not because you have to, but because you get to. And so today I want to be careful that we're not talking about social activism. We're talking about a spiritual renewal in our hearts. It's God calling his people back to the real heart of worship, a worship that does not only sing, but it goes out and serves, that not only believes, but it goes and blesses, that not only loves God, but loves all those that have been made in his image. Because whenever God's people forget justice, we are losing sight of his heart. So, before we move any further, can I ask you, what's the word? Rhetorically, so don't need to shout back at me, but maybe for you to dwell on. What does your worship look like from the moment you leave this building until you come back next Sunday? What does your worship look like? Does your faith, what you believe, shape how you go out and treat other people? Maybe your co-workers, your neighbours, your friends. Maybe even strangers. If someone was to look at your week, would they see a reflection of God's justice and mercy in the way that you live, spend your money, and serve? You see, what Isaiah 58 is all about is God saying, please don't just sing to me about my love. Sing and then go and show it to others. Don't just fast from food, fast from your own self-centeredness. Don't just cry out for revival. Become the kind of people that I can revive. to start with, we see, and I think this is the really important place to start, is that justice is rooted in the very character of God. Justice is rooted in the very character of God. In Isaiah 58, verses 6 to 7, it says this, well-known words that we read regularly, especially at Christmas time, we bring these out. Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice and to untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? See, what we notice in this chapter is that these people are doing all the right religious things. We've said they fast, they pray, they show up for worship, but they also complain when God doesn't seem to notice their devotion. Look at what we're doing. They say to the Lord, why have we fasted and you've not even seen it? But God replies, on the day of your fasting, what are they doing? They're exploiting their workers. In other words, you say that you love me, but you don't love the people that I love. Their religion hadn't touched their relationships. Their worship hadn't touched the world. And I know when we hear the word justice, we can often think of politics, ideological movements that are going on. But in Scripture, it's not just a political category. It's a character trait of God himself. The Hebrew word in Isaiah that he uses is mishpat. It means to give people what they are due, whether that's protection, care, or accountability. But in the Bible, it's not just a cold legal fairness. It's a deeply relational thing of offering protection, offering care, and offering accountability. Keller says this. He says, biblical justice is the outworking of the very character of God, which is never less than just. Justice isn't something that God occasionally does on the odd occasion. I'm going to be just today. I'm going to be just to this person. It's who he is. He cannot but be just. And a beautiful psalm in 146 says this, the Lord upholds the cause of the oppressed. Let me read that again. The Lord upholds the cause of the oppressed and gives food to the hungry. The Lord watches over the foreigner and sustains the fatherless and the widow. I mean, what a heart. Just dwell on that for a minute. That is our Creator God's heart, to uphold the cause of the oppressed, to give food to the hungry. The Lord watches over the foreigner, sustains the fatherless and the widow. God's heart is always leaning towards the vulnerable, always lifting the oppressed. So guys, if that's who he is, then to know him means to care for the very things that he cares about. Another verse in my Bible in the year that I've been doing recently was Jeremiah 22:16. It says of the righteous king, it says, he defended the cause of the poor and the needy, and so all went well. Is that not what it means to know me, declares the Lord? Defending the cause of the poor and the needy. Is that not what it means to know me? See, biblical knowledge isn't just information. It has to transform our hearts, doesn't it? If we claim to know God but are indifferent to injustice, then there's something awry. We might know about God, but maybe we don't yet share his heart. I want you to imagine a man who loves a father, and then he goes and mistreats that father's children. Would you believe that he truly loves that father? Of course not, you wouldn't. And in the same way, we cannot say that we love the Father in heaven while ignoring his children on earth, no matter who they are. If we worship the God of justice, our lives will reflect his justice. And that's what Isaiah 58 is calling out. The people that say they love God, but they exploit their workers, they ignore the hungry, and they neglect the poor. Their religion looks right on the surface, but then you look at their relationships, and they're all wrong. God says, that's not fasting. That's hypocrisy. See, justice is central to true worship. It's not an optional add-on. It's not just something for the especially generous people to do. It's actually a mark of knowing God. So when we meet the God of the Bible, we see that he's not a God of comfort necessarily. I mean, he does comfort us, but it's not about making us comfortable or being convenient. He actually pulls on our hearts. He pulls our hearts out of self-protection and leads us towards compassion. Because when we look at the cross, guys, when we see the God who does justice and mercy, a God who loves righteousness and yet stoops down to rescue the undeserving like myself. So before we talk about doing justice, we've got to understand where it comes from. It comes from the very heart of who God is himself. So I'm going to ask you just to reflect for one moment before we continue. Nathan, you don't mind sticking on the questions for me, please. It says this. Some questions for you. Do we love what God loves? Do we share the same heart? Do we love what God loves? The people that he's created. Do we care for the people that he cares for? The oppressed, the poor, the vulnerable. When God looks at our worship, does he see hearts of compassion or hearts of convenience? I'm just going to give you 1 minute maybe just to look and to dwell on those things, challenge us. See, justice is not a trend that comes and goes. It's actually a reflection of what God's heart is. And that brings us to the next point, which is if justice is rooted in who God is, then true worship, worship that truly pleases him, must naturally produce justice and mercy. And so secondly, we see that true worship produces justice and mercy. In Isaiah 58, verses 3 to 7, it says this: why have we fasted and you've not seen it? Why have we humbled ourselves and you've not noticed it, God? And God replies, yet on the day of your fasting, you do as you please and exploit all your workers. Your fasting ends in quarreling and strife and in striking each other with wicked fists. Is not this the kind of fasting that I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice, to untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood. You see, God is confronting empty religion here, false worship. They think they're doing everything right, and they feel God is ignoring them. And they complain, why are you not noticing what we're doing? And God replies, it's because your religion is self-centered. It's all about you. It's not about the people that I love. You fast, you exploit your workers, you humble yourselves in church, but you fight and gossip outside of it. But I don't want religious performance. I want relational righteousness. I don't want hunger for food. I want hunger for justice. Tim Keller says, God measures your spirituality not by how you sing, but by how you serve. God measures your spirituality not by how you sing, but how you serve. And that's the difference between ritual and relationship. True worship doesn't end at the end of the final song on a Sunday. It spills out into how we go and treat others the rest of the week. And so let's look at this again. So what does true worship look like? It says, I've highlighted it here, to loose the chains of injustice. Oh, wow. To set the oppressed free. We were oppressed from our sin, weren't we? And he set us free. To share your food with the hungry, to provide the poor wanderer with shelter, to clothe the naked, to not turn away from your own flesh and blood. That is true spiritual worship. Don't just say you love me. Show it by how you treat people. Don't just deny yourself food. Share your food with someone who's hungry. Don't just pray for revival, become the answer to somebody's prayer. That is the heartbeat of true worship. Private devotion into public compassion. And just hope, I found this really helpful as well, where Tim Keller talks about the difference between justice that we maybe just think of as like political justice and what biblical justice actually is. And he says there's four things towards biblical justice. Number one, it outworks itself in radical generosity. He says that all that we have belongs to God, and we know this, don't we? And we are just stewards of it. We're not owners. Generosity isn't something that we get extra credit for. It's justice being generous. That's being just. Deuteronomy 15 teaches that open-handedness towards the poor is a reflection of God's generosity to us. It's if we have and we don't share. Tim Keller says it's not that you're stingy. The Bible would call it, it's that you're unjust. That really stung when I read that. If we have and we don't share, it's not stinginess. It's actually injustice. Well, secondly, the second mark of biblical justice is universal equality. Basically, everyone is made in God's image. This means there's no favoritism, not for race, class, or status. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great. But judge your neighbor fairly, it says in Leviticus 19. In God's kingdom, no one is to be invisible. Thirdly, there's life, Nathan, is life-changing advocacy. It's not about feeling bad about injustice. It's standing up for those who have no voice. Proverbs 31, verse 8 and 9 says this, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. It means using our own influence, our resources, our relationships to lift up those who have been pushed down. And then fourthly, bit of a mouthful, asymmetrical responsibility. Sounds glamorous, but it's pretty simple. Those who have much more power, more wealth, more stability, bear more responsibility. And we see Jesus says this in Luke 12, to whom much is given, much will be required. If we have received grace, then we are accountable to extend it to others. And of course, there's this beautiful picture in the Old Testament that we see of gleaning the edges of the field, don't we? And it's just a really beautiful thing that was built into God's law for his people, was that the farmers were not to harvest to the edge of the field. They were to leave a portion of it for the poor and for foreigners to collect. And what was interesting about this is not about charity. The reason was for justice. It was built into the very fabric of their community so that everyone could eat with dignity. It was about building a society that was shaped by generosity. Those that had much would share it with others. And so this question has been bugging me this week as I prepared this earlier this week. What are the edges of your field? Where could you leave room in your life, your schedule, your home, your finances, for somebody else to flourish? I'm just going to leave a minute for you just to take that in for a moment. I will do it in a moment, but I'm just going to add something to that. Because we are very good in the West at filling our time. And we all have the same amount of time, but we fill it often with really good things. But often we don't leave much margin, or margin for things that might be God's heart. And I've been challenged by this week. Where are the edges in my field that I've left so that I can have time, space, finance, to help someone else flourish? I'm going to be quiet for a moment now as you think about that yourself. always flows outward. Just some of the questions maybe to think about. If you want to know whether your worship is outflowing towards the streets, look at your relationships. Are you fair with your employees if you have them? Are we kind to those who can't repay us? Are we generous with our time and our resources? If our worship stays in the building but doesn't reach the streets, God does say that's not really true worship at all. It's just smoke with no fire. James puts everything pretty plainly in his letter, doesn't he? Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. And that's what Isaiah 58 is all about. Faith that acts, not just faith that talks. But here's the great news, and please don't switch off, because this final point will kind of hopefully put the right spin on this, is the gospel is the thing that empowers us to do justice. It's the gospel that does it. Look at Isaiah 58 verses 8 to 12. They're on the screen again. It says, "Then your light will break forth like the dawn." This is after him saying, care for the poor, care for the oppressed, all that. He says, "Then your light will break forth like the dawn, and your healing will quickly appear. Then your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help, and he will say, 'Here I am.'" What a tone shift there is here. After exposing false worship, God gives this incredible promise to his people, saying, "Look, if you loose the chains of injustice, you will break forth like the dawn." Did you catch that? So justice and mercy are not to be a burden. They are to be a blessing. They're not how we earn his favor. It's how we reflect it. And that's exactly what, in fact, another quote from Tim Keller on this. He says this: "You will never do justice unless you are transformed by the one who became justice for you." In other words, you can't sustain a life of justice through guilt or obligation. You'll burn out. You'll grow cynical. The only lasting fuel for justice is the grace of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then we have to think about this, because this is the moment where justice and mercy met, wasn't it? No event in history displays both perfect justice and perfect mercy than the cross of Jesus Christ. The truly innocent person, condemned as a criminal, the judge of all the earth, was then judged in our place. Mercy was poured out because sinners were forgiven. And at the cross, God's justice demanded the penalty, and God's love provided the substitute. That's what makes a Christian a totally unique motivation for doing justice. We don't seek justice to get God to love us. We do justice because he already has loved us. You see, the gospel changes how we see people, and this is really crucial for us to kind of be dwelling and thinking upon. If you think that you've earned your place in life, then you're going to look down at others of people that are struggling. You'll just think they should just try harder. But when you understand the gospel, that everything you have is a gift of grace, it kills the pride that is in us and births compassion. Like every day when I walk up to this building on the high street, I live not far from here, and as I walk along, I pass so many people every day that are just in great need. Some sitting on the floor begging for money, some just in a right state. And there is occasion, I'm going to confess to you now, that I can walk past and I can think to myself, man, they've made some bad choices in their life, haven't they? But at that point, I have categorically forgotten the gospel. Because Jesus saw me as spiritually bankrupt, and he didn't walk on by. He gave himself for me. He gave himself for us. That means that justice isn't an act of pity. It's an act of identification. You look at someone in need and say, there I am, apart from the grace of God. Have you ever done that? When you see someone on the street and just say, that could be me, but by the grace of God. When grace takes root in our heart, we stop asking, how little can I give? And we start asking, how much can I pour out? And that's the transformation that Isaiah 58 promises. God promises in Isaiah 58, light breaking forth, healing flowing, God saying, here I am. And one of my favorite stories in the Bible is when Jesus meets Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, a tax collector who's wealthy, corrupt, and basically not a great guy, very unjust. But then he encounters Jesus and absolutely everything changes for him. He didn't just pray a prayer and then attend the synagogue every week after that. He said, Lord, I give away half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody, I will give them back four times what I have taken from them. You see, that's justice and mercy in action, isn't it? Jesus didn't command him to do that. It was a natural outflow. Grace compelled him to do that. Look what you've done for me. I need to do this for other people. Saving grace produces social grace. A redeemed heart leads to a restored community. And just as we kind of end our time, or end this part of the gathering, we have to be careful that we don't think I should be doing more. I think that's how we can hear this sometimes. I must be doing more. I should be doing more. But that's not the tone of this passage at all. It's not the gospel tone either. God isn't saying, do justice so I'm going to bless you. He's saying, when you walk with me, when you reflect my heart, you will be blessed. Verse 11 says this, the Lord will guide you always. He will satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land and will strengthen your frame, and you will be like a well-watered garden. That's the picture of a life rooted in grace, overflowing with life, blessing other people. When that gospel, when the gospel grips our heart, justice stops being a checklist and starts being a joy. You stop serving out of guilt and you start serving out of gratitude. Now, we're going to be at different places with this. And what I mean by that is, some people, naturally, their heart is breaking for a people group at the moment. And they're like, yes, more. I want to do more. Some of us maybe be a little bit earlier on in that spectrum thinking, can you just break my heart for someone, Lord? I need you to help my heart break for someone. It doesn't feel like that. I feel like I'm lacking compassion. And so hopefully, Nathan, you don't mind sticking on the next slide. This is helpful for us as a starting point. We might be at different points on this spectrum. Because I don't want us to leave here and just stay the same. I don't want us to leave here and just think, well, that was nice. Nice that God's heart is for all these people. Because God's heart is for us to go and reflect his heart to other people. And so here we go. What could it mean for us? Well, number one, it could mean, I think it means for everybody, but at very least, start with worship, not activism. Let justice flow from time spent in God's presence. We act because we've been acted upon by grace. We can only truly move out in a way that is out of true worship when it comes from a place of having worshipped him first and foremost. Otherwise, we will be led to doing it out of guilt and out of duty. We don't want to do that. Maybe for some of you, it's seeing people through gospel eyes. Every person you meet is an image bearer of God and a potential recipient of his mercy. I mean, when you're walking the streets and you see somebody, maybe your prayer could be, if there's a bit of fear about going up to them, and that may be good fear at times. Every person, they are an image bearer of God and the potential recipient of his mercy. Do we view people like that? Number three is live generously and intentionally. Have you identified the edges of your field, the resources, the time, the space at which to give to help somebody else flourish? And fourthly, maybe you're at a space where you want to advocate and fight for someone who can't speak, using your voice, your skills, your influence, not to gain power, but to give it away. What could this look like for you? Because we want to be a church. This is what the world needs. Churches and the worldwide church that is so moved with God's heart that we are going out in compassion to everybody. This morning on the way up, I googled famous Christians that have made significant contributions to justice and social reform. William Wilberforce, a prominent politician and leader of the movement to abolish the slave trade. Lord Shaftesbury, a dedicated social reformer who fought for better conditions for factory workers and child labourers. Elizabeth Fry, a Quaker minister and pioneer in prison reform, she campaigned for humane treatment of prisoners, especially women and children. John and Charles Wesley, who started the Methodist movement, put in education reforms for the poor and helped abolish slavery. Aloda Aquano, a freed slave writer who was a pioneer in British abolition of slavery, who wrote an influential book about his experience of slavery and helped abolish slavery alongside William Wilberforce. Florence Nightingale, a social reformer, statistician, and founder of the modern nursing. Her Christian faith motivated her efforts to improve sanitization and healthcare. The list goes on. Now, we may not be a Florence Nightingale, we may not be a William Wilberforce, but all these things that have happened, other Christians have got involved with as volunteers, supported, championed in their workplaces, in their communities. And it's what we're to do, to let our light shine forth. But it all starts with worship of him who loves us first and foremost. So I'm just going to leave some space now, if that's all right, just to dwell upon those questions there. Where are you at? Where do you need to start? And I would love it if we could write down like an action point or something that you feel like the Lord is prompting you to obey off the back of this. Because we might do a sermon on this again in two years' time. And we don't want to be in the same place as we are now, do we? We want to be, yes, I listened to this and I was an obeyer of the word. The Lord spoke to me. Because the Lord speaks to you individually as we hear the preached word. What is he calling you to obey? And give a bit of space for that now.
doing in your heart and what you might be being convicted of or encouraged to do, or how you might apply this as you go out from this place. At Oikos, we really want to be hearers and doers of the word. As Dan has already shared, we don't want to leave here and our worship to have ended when the singing ends, and our thoughts about how we're going to live this out to end when we get back in our car or back in our house or back in our working week tomorrow. So you may have written down something. I've been thinking about this for myself. I'm just going to share with you, and then as we have this time. At the beginning, I introduced myself, you know, as I did that little activity, and one of the things I could have said is I'm somebody who will quite often, if I've decided I'm going to do something, I'll just get on and do it. And there's a strength to that, because it's important to do what we say we're going to do. But I can also be a bit blind and a bit stubborn and just keep doing something without necessarily examining why I'm doing it or checking my heart. And so one of the things I've been challenged by from today is this thing about starting with worship, not activism. Sometimes I can just do it because it should be done, rather than checking my heart to begin with. And another thing for me from today, Dan said, when God looks at my worship, does he see a heart of compassion or a heart of convenience? And I'll tell you what, my heart is very often directed by convenience and not compassion. Now, it might be some different things for you. What I'm going to do, because I don't want to forget that, because I know tomorrow I go back to school, life takes off. I'm going to put a reminder in my phone for every day this week to come on early in the morning, reminding me to start with worship, not activism, and ask the question, God, where do you want to inconvenience me today? I'm going to do that in front of you now. I'm going to put that reminder in my phone. And I'm going to encourage you, is there a reminder maybe to talk to a neighbor, or just like me, to start with the right heart? What is it, as we leave here, that you want to be reminded of this week to be a doer of whatever God has put on your heart right now? So I'm going to do that. You don't have to do that. You may have a different way of doing it. But I know I've written it here, but I will shut this book and I might not read this book again this week. But this will buzz once a day. And then we will stand in a couple of minutes and we're going to sing, O Church, Arise, together. I'm not very good at technology, but I think I've put a reminder in my phone to buzz up each day. But I'll let you know next week if I think it's worked. Just before we stand and sing our final song, and just a heads up in that, I will be passing around the collection basket. Some people choose to give financially in this way, feel no compulsion or obligation. But as part of our worship, I know that's something that some people do. But before we sing, Adrian is just going to briefly share something with us, and then we'll